Just a word about this tiger inside Wittgenstein's mind. When I put together a heterogeneous group of essays in the volume Wittgenstein's Vienna Revisited, I realized that I had essays there on three of the 10 figures that Wittgenstein mentions in Culture and Values having influenced it. And I thought I could give a course on them, and I could more or less do this without thinking. So I thought. When I finally got down to the work of preparation, I realized that I wanted and deeply desired to get back into Schopenhauer and to read all of Spengler, etc. And I ended up, in fact, producing a book which Gary has at the moment, Assembling Reminders, which has a chapter on all 9 of the 10, because I only very, very recently, in the past couple of weeks, begin to get some idea of how Schrapper fits into the picture. And as I worked on this material, elucidating this text, it has become a very exciting adventure, because I really had the sense that in some strange kind of way, I managed to get inside Wittgenstein's mind to understand its concept of philosophy in what for me was a new and exciting way. That's where the upper part of the title comes from. And in having done that, it's possible to look at different aspects of Wittgenstein's conception of philosophy from the point of view of their genesis, and to demystify, if you like, to demystify. So in this case, the aesthetic side of his philosophy. The background in science. I mean, when you know that he's coming from postmodern Hertz, and you have looked very closely at postmodern Hertz, as Wittgenstein might have. Another interesting question I'll come back to later. You see why he's never ever tempted by anything remotely looking like logical positivism. In any case, let me begin. Philosophie dürfte man eigentlich nur dichten. This text is normally translated as philosophy can only really be written as poetry. It's a big mistake in this translation. Dichtung, if you look at the classical expositions of the parts of literature, Dichtung is a generic and not a specific term. It refers to epic, lyric, and dramatic poetry. So it'll be the three types. If you say in English that philosophy is poetry, you mean that a philosopher does what T.S. Eliot does. And Wittgenstein is not saying that. And in fact, if you look at philosophy as being poetry, you're not going to get very far in understanding what Wittgenstein says about philosophy in other places, or about his own about his own way of doing it. I mean, his philosophical Dichten involves descending into chaos. I mean, this is another text in Culture and Value, and thinking crazier than analytic philosophers do. And that's not a good description of T.S. Eliot or Ezra Pound or Goethe or Rilke. Who is a good description of? I'll come back to that too, also. Poetry is also not a terribly good description of the private language, so-called private language argument. I mean, if you're looking for poetry there, you're going to have to look very, very hard, and very long, and very curiously, because it doesn't have any of the characteristics that we associate with, in what in German is called Lyrik. So that's the question. My question here is how does Wittgenstein, who started with Frege and Russell in philosophy, who never could have said philosophy goes to my get to that view? That's what I'm going to try to explain in the course of the next few minutes. Okay. My answer to all, to in general, it has been supplied by Brian McGinnis. When I first read Young Ludwig, the following text jumped out at me. It was one of the, I didn't mark up very much, but that was one thing I marked very heavily. Philosophy for Wittgenstein was a craft, a discipline, and its value consisted in its being well done. So one should do it well and not preach about it. Showing, not saying, was important. Like all crafts, its exercise at its highest produces beauty, a beauty which requires an intellectual effort to grasp. So that's from Young Ludwig. And it's quite logical that Wittgenstein would be a craftsman. And this is a second part of my, a second point that I'd be making. Wittgenstein is a craftsman and not an artist. Now, in ancient Greek, there's no difference, and in modern Greek also, between the two, between art and craft, but we do make this distinction, and there's a good reason, I think, for making it with respect to Wittgenstein. I've mentioned also that I've already mentioned the so-called private language argument. It's certainly not art. Philosophical art, if you compare it with probably the three paradigm cases you might have outside of analytic philosophy, Nietzsche's elegance, Heidegger's provocative obscurity, or Derrida's cunning deconstructions. The basis of the artistry there is imagining examples. I went through this very, very quickly, and quickly, without really digging, found 20 cases in those parts of the philosophical investigations, normally referred to as the private language argument, where Wittgenstein says, "Denke dir, imagine such and such a situation. Imagine a child doing this. Imagine this." And the beauty within the private language argument is anything but conventional. In a way in which we think of poetry as being beautiful. I cite a text here that it's important in philosophy to know when to stop, when not to ask a question, something that he says, this is cited in Kleiger's new book, where Jim's making a big point about this, you know, it's important in philosophy not to beat the issue to death, to say just the right amount of things. And that reminded me of what we've had right from the beginning in Wittgenstein's study. We had Malcolm's biography, the biographical essay, where he says his toilet isn't working, and they fix the toilet. He fixes the toilet, and he wants to continue doing it. Wittgenstein says, "Leave the bloody thing alone. It's working. It's doing what it's supposed to do." So there's a certain sense of what's appropriate to doing something or to discussing something that we have in Wittgenstein. Now let's come to this text that I've been playing with for the last, I would say, 6 or 7 years. I think there's some truth in the idea that I think only reproductively. I don't believe that I ever invented a line of thinking. I've always taken one over from someone else. I've simply straightaway seized upon it with enthusiasm for my work of clarification. That is how Boltzmann, Hertz, Schopenhauer, Frege, Russell, Krauss, Lohse, Weininger, Spengler, Straffer have influenced me. Now, I take this, take the case of Breuer and Freud as an example of Jewish reproductiveness. What I invent are new similes. Well, I'm actually comparisons. Once again, this is the, I mean, I had Winch's translation there, which I criticized, especially with respect to this word Gleichnis, comparison here. It's very, very difficult to translate. It's typical of a Jewish mind like mine to understand someone else's work better than he understands it himself. It comes at the end of this, the same passage. And that is, I think, the key to understanding this long passage, in which Wittgenstein tells you, as Brian McGinnis said, he tells you where he comes from. So there are lots of people, and I'm one of them, who have been looking around in the garbage dumps of the history of philosophy, trying to find some kind of key to Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein tells you the whole story here, in this text. Now this text is very, very often quoted, and we come across it in nearly every book on Wittgenstein nowadays. You notice that there are no commas after Boltzmann, Hertz, and Schopenhauer, or after Krauss, Loos, Weininger. It was always Pickler's service to have shown that in the original version, it's Russell, it's Frege, Russell, Spengler, Schlaffen. He then adds these other people afterward. So that I take this to mean Wittgenstein began his philosophizing with Frege, even though he had read people like Boltzmann and Hertz and Schopenhauer before. He started with Frege and Russell, but his way of looking at Frege and Russell was conditioned by Boltzmann, Hertz, and Schopenhauer, who in turn he received when he began doing philosophy in 1911. When he made the choice, to become a philosopher rather than an aeronaut or a psychologist, one of the two options he had. When he picked up the challenge of Frege and Russell, it was with a certain foreknowledge of different aspects of philosophical issues that he had already gleaned from Boltzmann, Hertz, Schopenhauer, who he then had rethought really on the basis of Frege, especially. And well, that worked out in the various chapters of this book, how he was able to read these people, how you find astonishingly in the so-called philosophy chapter of the Philosophical you find echoes, you hear. If you know Boltzmann's Populäre Schriften, you hear it. You hear it that simply when Wittgenstein writes about philosophy. So he had big chunks of Boltzmann also in his head as he did at Frege, obviously, because Boltzmann doesn't turn up anymore in the Nachlass. He doesn't turn up in the correspondence in any significant way. Goes virtually unmentioned, but Boltzmann is nevertheless there. The case with Hertz is rather different because we know his whole life long he always told people, "Do you want to learn how to do philosophy? Read the Introduction to the Principles of Mechanics, and you get it all there quite clearly." As I say, I've worked through, I've produced hypotheses with respect to all these people, how they came into Wittgenstein's, what he calls here, my work of clarification, his concept of philosophy, not necessarily the individual positions he's taking, but his approach, his strategies. And the question that I want to tackle today is that of where the aesthetic moment in his method arises. And it doesn't arise all at once, it arises in several different stages. And I chose this text about craftsmanship from McGinnis because I believe that's a key to understanding especially this dimension. Of his concept of philosophy. Remember, why not craftsman? Wittgenstein was a trained engineer, And he began looking at things, and he continued to look at things very much as an engineer did, get the job done, get it done right, and leave it. Okay, in this group, there is only one Dichter, and that's Karl Kraus. And so if you want to understand philosophy as Dichtung in Wittgenstein, the place to go is Karl Kraus. And Karl Kraus is a very different kind of Dichter from Rilke or from a T.S. Eliot. The text here, I mean, the text from Kraus chosen is perhaps his best known his best known prose text from the beginning of 1915, when he announces after several months of silence that he is completely against World War I begins, in these great times things are happening that could not be imagined, and which what you can no longer imagine must happen, or if one could imagine it, it would not happen, and this goes on. This paragraph, this sentence is nearly a page in the pocket, nearly a page long, with an incredibly complicated grammar to it, and I mean, it reads strangely, but I've cited the central aspect of what Kraus is getting at here to remind you of an essential part of what Kraus saw himself as doing as a Dichter. This is an essential part of his polemic, to set the world on its feet again, a metaphor that we find in way back with Frege and find also in Marx, this idea that the world we live in is an inverted world, eine verkehrte Welt. And you have to set the world back on its feet again, and that means you have to grasp it. You have to grasp it polemically in the imagination, because Kraus believes that and this is the epitaph of the 20th century, the unimaginable happens all the time. And because we aren't capable of imagining something like World War I, it happens. Well, the same is true of the finance crisis. I mean, this is our world. And Krauss's way of attacking that is to go after the way things are said in this inverted world, and to show the vanity and emptiness of the phrase in the press, which covers up as a kind of camouflage the corruption of the society around him, and this is what he does most famously in the Letzten Tage der Menschheit, in his great satire on World War I, a play that would take 24 hours if you performed the whole of it. A play that, as Kraus himself says, it's intended to be put on Mars. And so, I mean, this when Wittgenstein's talking about Dichtung, I mean, this is what he's talking about, clearly. Maybe not so clear. I believe if we take Wittgenstein himself seriously, I mean, this is the Dichter that he himself said, this is the Dichter that influenced me. And so I extrapolate from that. The Dichter in me is related to this kind of epic character. Okay, now how does this all happen? How does all of this become important? Well, I have to go back to the beginning of the story briefly. Wittgenstein decided to become a philosopher in 1911. What he gets from someone like Frege, I mean, it's quite simple. It's quite simplest. I mean, for his philosophy, is the principle of objectivity. Distinguish sharply between logic and psychology in everything you do. And so this first principle of Frege's, always listed first in his, when he talks about his basic ideas, Wittgenstein read very carefully. and examined it from all sorts of angles, and on my view, Frege became for him a mixture of Socrates and Montaigne. You know, he said, we know, he told Anscombe, my first philosophy was the Schopenhauer idealism, which I rejected, which I on the basis of having read Frege. So that there, I'm not speculating, on the basis of nothing, but taking many of the things we know about Wittgenstein at a reliable factual level, and feeding them into this scenario of the text from culture and value. Now, what's Russell's role here in the early days? What does he get from Russell? We know, once again, what Wittgenstein always praised in Russell was the theory of descriptions. And the theory of descriptions proceeds from the idea that language deceives us, that the exterior form of language deceives us. We need a technique. You see, this idea of technique comes into the comes very, very strongly into the story with Russell. We need a technique for dealing with the way in which language deceives us at the logical level. And so his way of analyzing the sentence that the King of France falls into the sentence that there is a King of France, and there's only one King of France, and that King of France is bald, enables you to understand how this proposition can deceive us. So you've got the idea of a technique. Now, in Russell, this is all tied up with this tendency to cheat in logic and to basically to make up the rules as he goes along to fit his way of playing. So you have the famous axiom of infinity, where Russell says, it fits my system better than the feeling for a number of objects. So we'll do it that way. This is sort of in the background. This is, I think, one of the things that leads Russell, that leads Wittgenstein to make a connection between the kind of unsayability you have in Frege and the kind of unsayability you have in the kind of showing you have in Karl Kraus. But that's not my theme today. Nevertheless, it needs to be mentioned. So, the elements of the craft of philosophy. Well, an engineer seeks a technique. And in philosophy, he gets the idea of a technique from Russell. I left out one step in here, and this is, you find already in Boltzmann, in Boltzmann's popular lectures, Boltzmann says, oftentimes something very small, like a small technical advance, can be of enormous importance in the development of science. He gives two examples. I'll just pick the more familiar one. Here is the example of Galileo's inclined plane. When Galileo wanted to measure the velocity of falling bodies, he couldn't let them drop because he couldn't measure it. He let them roll down an inclined plane where you could see that there's no difference between a heavier one and a lighter one. But Boltzmann said, this was a wise idea. Now, what I see Wittgenstein doing is on the basis of what he's learned from Russell, and going back to his earliest readings in philosophy, which I mean, he would have encountered Russell in 1911, 1912. I mean, this would be. Some 6-7 years earlier, as a young boy, young teenager, 14 or 15 years old, he's been reading about a lot of nation philosophy of science in the end, and he's read Harris. And remember, go back to this text. This text is so strange, and the strangest thing about it perhaps is that nobody knows it's strange. It's typical of a Jewish mind, like mine, you mean, to understand someone else's work better than he understands it himself. Now, I began all of this project. I have to step outside of my skin as lecturer at the moment and talk about something that happened and how I got started in all of this. Way back, I think it was 1990 or even before that, picking up Heinrich Hertz, picking up the German text of Heinrich Hertz in the Innsbruck Philosophy Department library, which inherited part of Victor Kraft's library, and reading this and suddenly realizing in this introduction that you could move directly from Hertz's introduction to the principles of mechanics to uncertainty without any making any steps in between. Because the fundamental idea, which we associate with the Duhem-Quine principle, which is so central in uncertainty, you know, what we take as basic, and that can change. This is already in Hertz, but in a strange kind of way. There's certainly not. I mean, Hertz said this about scientific ideas. But by the time I got through analyzing what I thought Hertz was saying to Wittgenstein, I realized you couldn't find this literally in Wittgenstein's in Hertz's text. And I, in fact, asked some Hertz, some people who knew about Hertz, to help me, and they were perplexed as well. And somebody actually ended up polemicizing with my first two attempts to extract the Hertzian dimension to Wittgenstein, and saying, "Well, this is nonsense with respect to both." What I hadn't realized is that Wittgenstein truly appears to have seen something in Hertz that Hertz didn't have a clue about, namely that if a problem arises in language, it has to be solved in language and not in some kind of policing of language. I mean, as to the uncertain with eliminate metaphysics by saying, okay, you can't talk about souls and God and all that stuff. For Hertz, the idea was you talk about things in a different way, and there was a different way of doing mechanics, where you didn't need the word force, where you didn't need that concept. You could structure the language of physics in a different way. Now, Hertz didn't speak this way, but Wittgenstein well might have, and perhaps did, in some context. The point is that when you look at Hertz's three criteria for models, the third one, appropriateness, the idea that a model has to be not only empirically adequate and logically consistent, it needs to be appropriate to the situation. Hertz describes there are two kinds of grammars we have. We have a grammar which is intended to help people learn a language. You have another kind of grammar for grammarians, for people who are experts. You can expand that analogy at great length. You can talk about many other different kinds of grammars as well. And the question is, what kind of a grammar do you need for the job you're doing? Very early in life, I believe Wittgenstein got the idea from Hertz that you eliminate philosophical problems by restating things. And I mean that this leads ultimately, and I've argued elsewhere for that. This is what the truth table is all about. In the end, it's a way of of getting straight about the distinction between tautologies, contradictions, and substantive propositions without saying a word about them, without saying anything, simply showing how the truth values relate to one another. This idea that this is a pure technique, which is a purely technical solution to a problem, but behind it you begin to get the notion that it has to be appropriate. And that's it's Hertz's term, and it's a notion that runs through all of Wittgenstein's philosophy. But what's the appropriate thing here? Okay, from Hertz we jump to Schopenhauer. And Schopenhauer made an enormous contribution to Wittgenstein's development. I mean, Frege is where he started. Is where he started with the idea of objectivity. But I mean, Wittgenstein's own his own world, as his family would have said it. I mean, he was the egoist. His sister was the altruist. And I mean, the idea that solipsism is a driving force in his life, as well as a consistently recurring theme in his philosophy, is central here. This is something that has to do with his confrontation with Schopenhauer, which interestingly, if one looks at the timetable here, one has a fairly good reason why the kinds of things that bothered Schopenhauer, the problem of the world, as I call it here, which is also the problem of death and suicide, would turn up in his life when he was around 15. I mean, because his brother, Rudy, committed suicide just around that time. So there's a correlation here, that the existential side of Wittgenstein, right from the beginning, is tied to, I believe, tied to experiences that he had. And I mean, for our purposes here, when we're looking at the aesthetic moment in Wittgenstein's philosophy, I mean, Schopenhauer, enough has been written about it, not to have to emphasize it, but Schopenhauer has this notion that art releases us from the everyday. Art presents us with in the act of artistic contemplation, the oven, the Kachelofen, beautiful Central European heating units. It becomes my whole world when I contemplate it. So art is a way of this thing.
Or it's just because you haven't touched it. Mm-hmm.
From fairly early on, and from his confrontation with Schopenhauer, Wittgenstein sees the possibility of seeing the world art as a way of coming to see the world rightly, coming to see something rightly, and coming to see the world rightly, are parallel in the notebooks. And so this is a second point. I've already talked about the Krausian moment here, the idea that the world as we experience it is an inverted world. And it needs to be put back on its feet. This is part of the mystical, the significance of the mystical in the Tractatus. It becomes demystified later on, and I mean, the inversion that he's interested in later on is less moral than kind of transcendental or quasi-transcendental, as I've sometimes said. Again, the forms of language, going back to Russell, the external forms of a language, the surface grammar receiving us. Now, on top of all of this, and indeed, I'll come back to an example. I once gave my doctoral students, a group of four very good doctoral students, we had a seminar where we read Hertz, Weininger, and Spengler. And after we had read Hertz and Weininger, probably the most imaginative of these guys is a mathematician as well as a philosopher. When you read Spengler, it's as though he comes out of these people. You know, lots of interesting things also about mathematics in Spengler that anticipate Wittgenstein. No. On top of all of this, Spengler turns up, and I mean, one of the things I should have put in here is a little bit about Adolf Loos, who comes into the picture. Interestingly enough, by the way, with respect to Krauss, with respect to Loos, I mean, I thought 1968, when I first got my hands on the Engelmann memoir, that we would someday discover a whole lot of stuff about how Wittgenstein received these characters. I mean, we don't know a hell of a lot more now with the whole Nachfass, with the whole correspondence, than we did then about really how Krauss and Loos influenced Wittgenstein. That's why it's important to get inside Wittgenstein's mind to solve. If we want to have some kind of a sense of a solution to the question where his concept of philosophy came from, how it arose, because you don't get any direct input. And he tells you himself, you know, I don't receive people passively. I pull things out and find things that they didn't find themselves in their own thinking. Important with respect to Adolf Loos is one very significant notion that runs through Loos's architecture, and that is it doesn't make a damn bit of difference what the house looks like on the outside. It's how it's built on the inside. And I could give you a lecture comparing fundamentally. The bourgeois Viennese apartments were made like the old palaces. The rooms were in a row, so you'd have to go through one room. There would be A, B, C, D, E, and get from A to D. You'd have to go through B and C, which makes things like privacy a bit problematic. I mean, I could show you such apartments today in Vienna. And Loos wanted to redefine the relationship between public and private within a private dwelling by introducing a multi-level intersecting layers into his buildings. He was very proud of the fact that you couldn't represent a Loos house in a two-dimensional drawing because you couldn't represent these layers. And it didn't make a difference at all to Loos where the windows, for example, were. Whereas from the Renaissance forward, I mean, the windows define the house. Coming into the 20th century, but for Loos, that made lots of people think, well, what Loos is doing is producing something ugly, because there's a great big window here. And then there's a big space, there's a little tiny window down there, and they don't stand in any kind of relation to each other. The positions of the windows are determined by the inside, by the construction of the house itself. You find this parallel in the art of furniture making. Talk just briefly about our friend Thomas Tempter. I don't know Thomas Tempter? his work. I mean, Thomas Temp does a very interesting Swedish carpenter who has been fascinated by the history of his craft. Now, he's not an educated person. He's a normal carpenter with an abnormal interest in the way craft is developed. And Thomas rebuilt the chair of Tutankhamun that was shown in the famous exhibition many years ago, because he looked at it and said, nobody would ever build a chair like that today. Nobody would ever conceive of forces being related to each other as they are in this chair. And so he had to understand that he had to rebuild it. Same to understand what happened to our way of looking at furniture after the development of veneer. He spent a lot of time reconstructing what was going on in Augsburg. And Augsburg was the first place where wood could be cut thin enough to make veneer. Veneer is important because it's with the development of veneer that you mask structure. So in the chairs that Thomas Tempe makes, they're inspired by the Tutankhamun chair. You don't have the smooth lines that you have here. You have for example, a piece coming out here with supports behind it, and instead of this, you have slanted pieces of wood holding the feet together. But all of the, so a good part of the structure is behind the seat. This all looks very, very strange. And when I first got my chairs, once again, they're marvelous, they're fantastic, they're incredibly comfortable, but they're sloggy. You know, well, once again, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. The beauty of craft isn't necessarily the beauty of art. And I mean, I want to come back then to the beauty of the private language argument. It's not the kind of thing you judge on the basis of conventional ideas about lyric poetry. Okay, I'll come to the final point, and this is Spengler, and Spengler is the really unmined source of more or less everything that Wittgenstein says about culture and about culture and value. And Wilhelm Kingster has apparently recently written a paper on this point, that culture and value is clearly a commentary on Spengler. Wittgenstein is more or less thinking about himself and his philosophy in relation to Spengler. All of the central concepts that get introduced there can be traced back to Spengler. And a whole lot of things that are important in the understanding of Wittgenstein's philosophy, philosophizing as an aesthetic exercise. And what again, Charles Thomason has picked up as the idea of physiognomic understanding, and what I call in my book the physiognomic turn that's just taken over from Spengler, this idea of physiognomy, the idea of appreciating the nuances of things, appreciating what can't be put into words, but is shown in detail, and the very important idea that comes along with that description is prior to explanation, and ideas drawn ultimately from Goethe. And by the way, one of the things that my approach to Wittgenstein shows is that how it could be that Goethe could exercise an enormous impact on Wittgenstein without ever appearing, or very seldom appearing, but very seldom, you know, in his works or in his private documents, etc. Because I mean, Spengler saw himself as finishing the work that Goethe started with the Farmlehrer. Well, Schopenhauer Goethe loved Schopenhauer because Schopenhauer was the only person who defended him against Newton among philosophers. Boltzmann dedicated his Populäre Schriften to Schiller. Boltzmann was a complete classicist. And I mean, he quotes half a line of Goethe in a very, very important place, where Boltzmann says, for example, science and religion are two different things. They're quite different things. And the reference to a line in Goethe, which so grau ist das Leben und grün.
No,
grau ist die Theorie, grün ist das Leben's goldener Baum.
We could look it up in the decent.
In any case, I mean, Boltzmann quotes half of this in one of his lectures. Wittgenstein quotes the other half. In culture and value. I mean, and it's certainly not accidental. It doesn't mean anything, but when you add up all of these things, a picture emerges. Now, all of the thinking about analogies and what analogies do in philosophy, I mean, it's not as though Wittgenstein's getting this from these two. He's reinforcing his own ideas and instincts, because Wittgenstein is first, last, and always a solipsist. He's getting a whole lot of impulses that he's storing up, and what's interesting about the story is they don't come out all at once. When he has, I believe, in connection with some things that Alois Pickler has developed in his dissertation and subsequently, and I believe that Wittgenstein's conception of philosophy is more or less finished. I mean, in this text where he describes all of these stages by these various people who had an impact on him and on his thinking. I mean, this is finished in 1932, but he doesn't realize it. He doesn't realize it until later. The project with Weismann is still going on. Then later on, he realizes wasn't possible from the beginning. This wasn't possible because his ideas were going in a different direction. So what you have is a sense of needing to get a job done in a different way, a sense of an alternative, a sense of appropriateness. A sense of structure, and of what it is to make something that holds, that doesn't necessarily have an external beauty, but has an internal beauty, like Ted's chair from the inside. I did come to see him. Okay, what will I have explained if all of this works? And you're getting so more or less a little bit of the steam from the tip of the iceberg, not even the tip of the iceberg from what I've been doing over these years. What I'm after, and what I think I can do to some extent anyway, to explain why Wittgenstein didn't want to do anything but what he did in philosophy, to untie the conceptual knots that misunderstanding and use of words produce. I mean, philosophy is not science, any kind of theory. Philosophy is not hermeneutics. It's not deconstruct. Has to do with all of these things, in some way or other. But it's not any of these. It's not missing anything. It leaves things as they are. Could be humanly useful. I believe in the end, Wittgenstein's self-criticism, his self-criticisms are tied to the fact that he was never particularly happy. The question is, basically, in the later philosophy, there is no single technique, but a myriad of techniques. I mean, in the early philosophy, it's fairly clear. The truth tables do the whole job. Getting straight about this logic status of propositions. Making this distinction between surface grammar and depth grammar is an endless activity, among other things, because you never, I mean, whom are you trying to convince? Who are you trying to convince? Who are you trying to speak to? But I think that this is, interestingly, Claudio makes a couple of points about this in his Wittgenstein in Exile, which aren't so bad. You can't solve everybody's problems all at once. And that's what you end up having to do somehow or other when you commit yourself to writing things down. And I think this is why he's always having trouble with all of that. So there is Wittgenstein's right from the beginning, from a different point, a series of different points from his colleagues like Russell and especially the philosophers of the Vienna Circle. I mean, they're in fact, I think, the people with whom he had most contact within philosophy. I mean, this project with Weismann begins in 1929, goes on from 1936. It's fairly intense. I don't know if he had any such intensive contacts later in Cambridge, even. You know, despite seeming efforts to get together, they never quite did, and probably couldn't. I mean, couldn't in the end. This is what he ends up recognizing, I believe. Cuts himself loose from these people once and for all in the mid 30s. I put a lot of ideas into the air with an amazing incoherence, and I'd be quite happy to discuss.